with it. He was going to be okay. The man ripped Jeffrey's clothing off him and wrapped him in blankets. "You'll be okay, boy. You'll be okay. Is this your doggie? She saved your life." Jeffrey didn't answer, but he looked briefly into my eyes. "Let's go," one of the men shouted, and they ran Jeffrey up the hill and into a truck, which took off with its siren screaming. I laid down in the mud. My limbs were shaking violently, and I, too, vomited, a clean pain slicing through me. I was so weak, I couldn't really even see. The cold rain pelted me, and I just lay there. A police car pulled up, cutting its sirens as it did so. I heard doors slam. "Ellie!" Maya screamed from the road. I raised my head, too tired to even wag my tail. She frantically ran down the bank, wiping at her tears. She was soaking wet, but I could feel her warmth and love as she hugged me to her chest. "You are a good dog, Ellie. You saved Jeffrey. You are such a good dog. Oh, God, I thought I'd lost you, Ellie." I spent the night at the vet's, and for the next several days I was so stiff I could barely move. Then Maya and I did school, only this one was all adults her age. We sat with lights in our eyes while a man talked in a loud voice, and then he came over and put a silly collar around my neck, while even brighter lights, the ones like silent lightning, popped on and off all around us, the way they did when I was with Mom, after the fire that hurt Ethan's leg. The man also pinned something on Maya's uniform, and everybody clapped. I felt pride and love coming off of Maya, and when she whispered to me that I was a good dog, I felt proud too. Not long after that, a new mood swept through the house. Maya and Al were excited and nervous and spent a lot of time having conversations at the table.
"If it is a boy, why can't it be Albert?" Al asked. "That's a good name."
"It's a great name, honey, but then what do we call him? You are my Albert, my Al."
"We could call him Bert."
"Oh, honey."
"Well, what are we going to call him then? Your family has so many people in it, you've used up every name there is. We can't call him Carlos, Diego, Francisco, Ricardo."
"What about Angel?"
"Angel? You want my son to be named Angel? I think maybe we shouldn't trust the naming of this child to a woman who named her cat Tinkerbell."
The cat, who was sleeping against me, didn't even raise her head at the sound of her name. Cats are like that. You can't get their attention unless they want to give it to you.
Maya was laughing.
"How about Charles?"
"Charlie? No, my first boss was named Charlie," Al objected.
"Anthony?
Don't you have a cousin named Anthony?"
"His name is Antonio," Maya corrected.
"Well, I don't like him. His mustache looks silly."
Maya collapsed into giggles at this. I thumped my tail once in recognition of all the hilarity. "George?"
"No."
"Raul?"
"No."
"Jeremy?"
"Of course not."
"Ethan?"
I jumped up, and Al and Maya stared at me in surprise. "I guess Ellie likes it," Al said.
I cocked my nose at them, uncertain. Tinkerbell was giving me a surly look. I trotted over to the door, lifting my nose. "What is it, Ellie?" Maya asked. There was no sign of the boy, and I was no longer sure I had heard right. Outside, some children rode past on bicycles, but none of them were Ethan. What was I thinking? That Ethan, like Jacob, would suddenly reappear in my life? I knew instinctively something like that would never happen to a dog. Still, Maya had said the boy's name, hadn't she? Why would she do that? I went to Maya for reassurance, then eased down with a sigh. Tinkerbell trotted over and pressed up against me, and I glanced away from Al's knowing look, a little embarrassed. Before long, we had a new person in the house, little Gabriella, who smelled like sour milk and seemed even less useful than the cat. When she first brought the child home, Maya carefully held Gabriella for me to sniff, but I wasn't too impressed. From that moment on, Maya would get up frequently during the night, and I would go with her, and she would clutch Gabriella to her chest while I lay at her feet. The unrestrained love flowing from Maya during those moments always nudged me into a deep, peaceful sleep. The aches in my bones were familiar to me. I'd felt the same way when I was Bailey and spent most of my time helping Grandpa do chores. Sights and sounds became dim, and this, too, was familiar. I wondered if Maya knew that the day was soon coming when I would no longer be with them. It only stood to reason that I would die the way Emmett and Stella died, because that was what happened. When I was Toby, when I was Bailey, it was the same thing. As I lay in a patch of sun, pondering this, I realized that I had spent my life as a good dog. What I had learned from my first mother had led me to Ethan, and what I had learned from Ethan had enabled me to dive into those black waters and find Jeffrey. Along the way, Jacob had taught me to find and show, and I had helped save many people. This had to be why, when I left Ethan, I was reborn as Ellie. Everything that I had done, everything that I had ever learned, had been leading up to being a good dog who saved people. It wasn't as much fun as being a doodle dog, but I now knew why these creatures, these human beings, had so fascinated me from the moment I saw them. It was because my fate was inextricably linked with theirs. Especially Ethan. That was the bond of a lifetime. Now that I had fulfilled my purpose, I felt sure I was at the end, that there would be no rebirth after this, and I was at peace with that. As wonderful as being a puppy could be, I wouldn't want to share it with anyone but the boy. Maya and Al had little Gabriella to distract them, making me sort of an afterthought in the family, except, of course, for Tinkerbell, who thought I was the family. I wondered briefly if cats also came back after death, then dismissed the thought, because as far as I had ever been able to tell, cats do not have a purpose. Embarrassingly, I had started to have trouble containing myself in time to make it outside, and was more and more frequently leaving messes in the house. Even worse, Gabriella had the same problem, so that the trash can often contained both of our bowel movements. Al took me on several front-seat dog car rides to see the vet, who petted me all over while I groaned with pleasure. "You're a good dog, you're just getting old," Al said. I wagged at being a good dog. Maya was very busy with Gabriella, so more and more it was just me and Al, which was okay by me. I could feel his tender affection every time he helped me up so we could take a car ride together. One day, Al had to carry me out into the yard to do my business, and I felt the sadness in him break sharply as he came to terms with what this meant. I licked his face in reassurance and put my head in his lap when he sat on the ground to cry. When Maya came home, she brought the baby outside, and we all sat together. "You've been such a good dog, Ellie," Maya said over and over. "You're a hero dog. You saved lives. You saved that little boy, Jeffrey." A neighbor lady came over and picked up Gabriella. Maya bent over her child, loving her, whispering something in her ear. "Bye-bye, Ellie," Gabriella said. She held out her hand,
and the lady stooped so I could lick it.
"Say bye-bye," the woman said.
"Bye-bye,"
Gabriella said again. The lady took Gabriella into the house.
"This is so hard, Al,"
Maya sighed.
"I know. If you want, I will do it for you, Maya,"
Al said.
"No, no. I need to be there for Ellie."
Al gingerly picked me up and carried me to the car. Maya got in the back seat with me.
I knew where we were going on this car ride. Groaning with all my aches, I collapsed on the seat, my head in Maya's lap. I knew where we were going and was looking forward to the peace it would bring me. Maya stroked my head, and I closed my eyes. I wondered if there were anything I would have wanted to do one more time. Find? Swim in the ocean? Stick my head out the car window? These were all wonderful things. I had done them all, though, and that was enough. I wagged my tail when they laid me on the familiar steel table. Maya was crying, whispering,
"You're a good dog,"
over and over, and it was her words and the sense of her love that I took with me when I felt the tiny prick by my neck, and then was washed away by the wonderfully warm ocean waters.
Chapter 26.
My new mother had a big black face and a warm pink tongue. I stared up at her numbly the first time I realized it was all happening again. It didn't seem possible, not after being Ellie. I had 8 other brothers and sisters, all of them black, all of them healthy, and full of play. For the most part, though, I preferred to wander off by myself and ponder what it meant that I was a puppy once more. It made no sense. I understood how I would never have been with Ethan if, as Toby, I hadn't learned how to open a gate, and from my days in the culvert learned that there was nothing to fear on the other side of the fence. With Ethan, I learned about love and companionship, and felt I was truly accomplishing my purpose just by accompanying him on his daily adventures. But Ethan also taught me how to rescue from the pond, so when I was Ellie and learned how to find and show, I was able to save the little boy from the tunnel of water. I would not have been so good at work if I hadn't had the experience of being Ethan's dog. Jacob's cold distance would have been incomprehensible and painful to me. But now what? What could possibly happen now that would justify my rebirth as a puppy? We were in a well-kept kennel with a cement floor, and twice a day a man came in and cleaned it out and took us out into a yard to romp in the grass. Other men and women spent time with us, lifting us and looking at our paws, and while I felt joy coming from them, none radiated that special love that I'd had with Ethan and with Maya and Al.
"Congratulations, you got a fine litter here, Colonel,"
one of them said, holding me up in the air as he spoke.
"Fetch top dollar."
"I'm worried about that one you've got in your hands there,"
another man replied. He smelled like smoke, and the way my new mother responded to him when he came into the kennel let me know he was her owner.
"Doesn't seem to have much energy."
"Yeah, the vet look at him?"
The man holding me flipped me over, running his thumbs under my lips to expose my teeth. I passively allowed this. I just wanted to be left alone.
"There doesn't seem to be anything wrong. He just goes off by himself and sleeps,"
the one called Colonel replied.
"Well, they can't all be champions,"
the first man said, setting me down. I felt unhappiness from Colonel as he watched me trot away. I didn't know what I could have done wrong, but I imagined I wouldn't be here long anyway. If previous experience had taught me anything, it was that people who had a litter of puppies liked them, but not enough to keep them. I was wrong, though. A few weeks later, most of my brothers and sisters were taken away by people, leaving just 3 of us left.
I felt a sad resignation from my new mother, who had stopped nursing us, but who still lowered her nose affectionately when any of us approached her to lick her face. She had apparently been through this before. Over the next several days, people came to visit us and play games, like putting us in pillowcases, jangling keys in front of us, and tossing a ball past our noses to see what we would do. None of this struck me as a very rational way to behave around puppies, but everyone seemed very serious about the whole thing.
"A lot of money for one so small," a man remarked to Colonel. "Sire's a 2-time national field champion, mother's placed in state 6 years in a row, won twice, and I think he'll get your money's worth," Colonel said.
They shook hands, and then it was just my mother and a sister I'd named Pounce, because she always leaped on me as if I couldn't see it coming. With her other brother gone, Pounce was on me relentlessly, and I found myself wrestling with her in self-defense. Colonel took note of my more active relationship, and I felt something like relief coming off him. Then Pounce was taken away by a woman who smelled like horses, and I was all alone, which I have to admit was how I preferred it.
"Have to lower the price, I guess," Colonel remarked a few days later. "Shame, that."
I didn't even raise my head or run over to him to try to convince him not to be disappointed in me, which he apparently was. In truth, I was feeling heartsick. I just couldn't understand what was happening to me, why I was a puppy again. The idea of going through training, of learning find with someone other than Maya or Jacob, of living another life, simply defeated me. I felt like a bad dog. I didn't race over to the fence to see people when they visited, not even when they had children. I didn't want to do that again either. Ethan was the only child I would ever be interested in.
"What's wrong with him? Is he ill?" I heard a man ask one day. "No, he just prefers to be off by himself," Colonel answered.
The man came into the kennel and picked me up. He had light blue eyes and regarded me kindly.
"You're just a mellow fellow, isn't it?" he asked me.
I sensed an eagerness inside him, and somehow I knew I would be leaving the kennel with him that day. I wandered over to my new mother and gave her a farewell lick on the face. She seemed to know it, too, and nuzzled me in return.
"Give you $250, the man with the blue eyes said.
I felt a sharp surprise in Colonel.
"What? Sir, this dog's paternity."
"Yeah, I read the ad. Look, it's for my girlfriend. She's not going to take him hunting, she just wants a dog. You said you'd make a deal. Now, I have to figure, if you've got a 3-month-old puppy and breeding dogs is what you do, there's some reason people don't want this one. I don't think you want this one either. So, I can go online and adopt a lab for nothing. I figure this one has all the papers and the pedigree, and I'll go $250. Anybody else lining up to buy this dog?" "I don't think so."
A little while later, the man was loading me into the back seat of his car. He shook hands with Colonel, who was letting me leave without so much as a farewell pat on the head. The man handed Colonel a small piece of paper. "If you're ever looking for a good deal on a luxury automobile, give me a call," the man said cheerfully.
I sized up my new owner. I liked that he was letting me be a front-seat dog, but when he gazed over at me, I felt nothing like affection coming from him, but rather a complete indifference. I soon found out why. I would not be living with the man whose name turned out to be Derek. My new home was with a woman named Wendy, who screamed and jumped up and down when Derek brought me into the house. Wendy and Derek immediately started wrestling together, so I found myself exploring the apartment in which I now lived. There were shoes and clothes scattered everywhere, and boxes with dried food stuck to the insides, sitting out on a low table in front of the couch. I licked these clean. Derek didn't radiate any particular affection toward Wendy either, even though he hugged her as he was walking out the door.
Whenever Al used to leave the house, the quick rush of love he felt toward Maya always made me wag my tail. But this man wasn't like that at all. Wendy's love for me was instant but confusing, a jumble of emotions that I didn't understand. Over the next several days, she named me Pooh Bear, Google, Snoop Dogg, Leno, and Pistachio. Then I was Pooh Bear again, though she soon just stuck with Bear and its variations. Barry Boo, Bear Bear, Honey Wunny Bear, Cuddle Bear, and Wonder Bear. She would hold me down and kiss me all over and squeeze me as if she couldn't get enough of me. And then the phone would ring, and she'd drop me to the floor to answer it. Every morning Wendy rummaged through her belongings, her feelings wrapped up in a roiling panic, saying, "I'm late, I'm late." She would bang out the door, and then I'd be alone all day, bored silly. She put newspapers on the floor, but I couldn't remember if I was supposed to pee on them or avoid them, so I did a little of both. My teeth were so sore, my mouth was watering, so I wound up chewing on a couple of shoes, which sent Wendy into a screaming fit when she saw it. Sometimes she forgot to feed me, and then I had no choice but to dive into the trash can for something, and this, too, caused screaming. As far as I could see, life with Wendy had no purpose whatsoever. We didn't train together. We didn't even walk together much. She would open the door and let me run around in the yard at night, but hardly ever during the day, and only then with an odd, furtive fear, as if we were doing something wrong. I became so frustrated, so full of pent-up energy, that I wound up barking, sometimes for hours straight, my voice ringing off the walls and back at me. One day there was a loud knock on the door. "Bear, come here," Wendy hissed at me. She locked me in her bedroom, but I could easily hear a man speaking to her. He sounded mad.
"Not allowed to have a dog. It's in your lease."
I cocked my head at the word dog, wondering if I might be the source of the man's anger. I hadn't, as far as I knew, done anything wrong, but all the rules were different at this crazy place, so who could say? The next time Wendy left for work, she broke the pattern, calling me over and sitting me down. She seemed completely unimpressed that I knew how to sit on command without being taught. "Look, Bear Bear, you can't bark while I'm gone, okay? I'll get in trouble with the neighbors. No barking, okay?" I could feel sadness at the edges of her feelings and wondered what it was all about. Perhaps she was bored all day, too. Why didn't she just take me with her? I loved car rides. I barked out my pent-up energy all afternoon, but I didn't chew any shoes. A day or so later, Wendy opened the door with one hand and pulled a piece of paper off the outside of the door with another. I raced over to her, my bladder bursting, but she didn't let me out. Instead, she looked at the paper and then started shouting angrily. I had no choice but to squat on the kitchen floor, and she smacked me on the bottom with an open palm and then opened the door. "Here, you might as well go out. Everybody knows you're here anyway," she muttered. I finished my business in the yard. I was sorry I had made a mess in the kitchen, but I simply hadn't had an option. The next day, Wendy slept in late, and then we got in the car and went for a long, long car ride. I was a backseat dog because of all the things piled on the front seat, but she did lower the window so I could poke my nose out of it. We pulled up in the driveway of a small house with several vehicles in the yard. I could tell by the smell of them that they hadn't moved in a long time. I lifted my leg on one of them. An older woman opened the door. "Hi, Mom," Wendy said.
"Is that it? It's huge. You said it was a puppy."
"Well, I named him Bear. What did you think?"
"This isn't going to work."
"Mom, I have no choice. I got an eviction notice," Wendy yelled angrily. "Well, what in the world were you thinking, anyway?"
"He was a gift from Derek. What was I supposed to do, take him back?"
"Why would he get you a dog when you can't have dogs in the apartment?"
Because I said I wanted him, too, okay? Mom, are you happy? I said I wanted a dog. God. The feelings the two women had toward each other were so complex, there was no way I could sort them out. Wendy and I spent the night in the tiny home, both of us a little afraid. There was a man named Victor who came home when it was dark, and he was so full of rage it made everything feel dangerous and crazy. While Wendy and I slept in a narrow bed in a cramped back room, Victor yelled in another part of the house.
I don't want a dog here.
Well, it's my place, and I'll do what I want.
What are we supposed to do with a dog?
That's a stupid question. What does anyone do with a dog?
Shut up, Lisa. Just shut up.
It will be okay, Barry Boo. I wouldn't let anything happen to you. Wendy whispered to me. She was so sad I licked her hand in reassurance, but that just made her cry. The next morning, the two women stood outside and talked next to the car. I sniffed along the door's edge, waiting to be let inside. The sooner Wendy and I left this place, the better.
God, Mom, how can you put up with him? Wendy said.
He's not so bad. He's better than your father.
Oh, don't start.
They stood silently for a minute.
I gave the air a sniff. It carried with it the sour fragrance of the garbage stacked up next to the house, which frankly smelled delightful. I wouldn't mind digging around in there some day.
Well, call me when you get home, the older woman finally said.
I will, Mom. Take good care of Bear.
Yeah. The woman put a cigarette in her mouth and lit it, blowing smoke out sharply. Wendy knelt beside me, and her sadness was so strong and familiar, I knew what was coming. She stroked my face and told me I was a good dog, and then opened the door and slid inside without letting me in. I watched the car drive away without surprise, though I wasn't at all sure what I had done. If I was such a good dog, why was I being abandoned by my owner?
Now what?
The woman standing next to me muttered, puffing her cigarette.
Chapter 27.
Over the next several weeks, I learned to stay away from Victor. Most of the time this was easy, as I was chained to a post in the backyard, and Victor never approached me. Often I could see him, though, sitting by a window in the kitchen, smoking and drinking. Sometimes at night he would come out into the backyard to urinate, and that was about the only time he talked to me.
"What you looking at, dog?"
he'd shout at me. There was never any happiness in his laughter. The days grew warmer, so for shade I dug out a scoop of earth between the sagging back fence and a machine that sat in the sun.
"Dog got dirt all over my snowmobile,"
Victor yelled when he saw what I had done.
"Thing hasn't run in 2 years,"
the woman Lisa screamed back. They yelled at each other a lot. It reminded me a little of when Mom and Dad would get angry and shout, except at this house I'd sometimes hear a thud and a cry of pain, usually accompanied by the sound of bottles knocking together and falling to the floor. A nice old lady lived in a place behind the rotten wooden fence, and she started coming over to talk to me through the gaps and holes in the boards.
"Such a nice doggie. Do you have water today?"
she whispered the first really hot morning. She left and soon reappeared with a pitcher, from which she poured a cool stream of water into my dirty bowl. I lapped it up gratefully and licked the thin, shaking hand she extended through the fence hole. The flies buzzing around my stools landed on my lips and eyes, driving me a little crazy. But mostly I didn't mind lying in the backyard, as long as I could be away from Victor. He scared me. The malevolence flowing from him communicated a real sense of danger. I was reminded of Todd and the man with the gun who hurt Jacob. I'd bitten both men. Did that mean I would someday be biting Victor?
I simply could not believe that my purpose in this life was to attack humans. It was beyond unacceptable. The mere thought made me sick. When Victor was not home, I would bark, and Lisa would come out and feed me and let me off the chain a little bit, but I never once barked when he was in the house. The lady on the other side of the fence brought me little pieces of meat, which she poked through the hole. When I caught the meat as it fell through the air, she laughed with real delight, as if I had performed an amazing trick. It seemed the only purpose I really had, bringing a little bit of joy to a mysterious woman whose face I couldn't quite see.
"This is a shame, a real shame. They can't do this to an animal. I'm going to call somebody," she'd say.
I could feel how much she cared about me, though it was strange because she never came into the yard to play. One day a truck pulled into the driveway, and a woman got out dressed just the way Maya used to dress, so I knew she was a police officer. For a moment it felt as if she had come to fetch me to find, because she stood at the gate to the backyard and stared at me, writing something down. That didn't really make sense, though. And when Lisa came outside, her hands on her hips, I lay down. The police officer handed Lisa a piece of paper.
"The dog's just fine," Lisa shouted at her, really angry.
I sensed the old lady standing behind me, just on the other side of the fence. She was breathing quietly while Lisa raged. That night, Victor yelled about me even more than usual, the word dog popping up every few seconds.
"Why don't we just shoot the damn dog?" he yelled.
$50? For what? We're not doing anything wrong."
Something crashed in the house, a violent noise that made me cower.
"We have to get a longer chain and clean up all the crap in the yard. Read the ticket,"
Lisa shouted back.
"I don't have to read the ticket. They can't make us do a damn thing. It's our property."
That night, when Victor came out into the yard to urinate, he put his hand out to steady himself against the house and missed, tumbling to the ground.
"What are you staring at, stupid mutt?" he mumbled at me. "Take care of you tomorrow. Not paying any $50.
I slunk down low against the fence, not even daring to look back at him. The next day, my focus was distracted by a butterfly who was flittering around in front of my face, so I was startled when Victor suddenly appeared before me.
"You want to go for a car ride?"
Victor crooned at me. I didn't wag at the words. Somehow he made it sound like a threat instead of a treat. "No," I thought, "I do not want to go for a car ride with you."
"It'll be fun. See the world," he said,
his laugh turning into a cough that caused him to turn and spit on the ground. He unclipped my chain from the post and led me to his car, yanking me around to the back of it when I stopped at the door. He inserted his key, and the trunk popped open.
"In you go," he said.
I sensed his anticipation and waited for a command I understood.
"Okay,"
he said. He reached down and gripped me in the loose skin at the back of my neck and above my tail. There was a quick flash of pain as he hoisted me up, and then I was in the trunk, sliding on some greasy papers. He unsnapped my leash and let it pool on the floor in front of me. The lid slammed down, and I was in near total darkness. I was lying on some smelly, oily rags that reminded me of the night of the fire, when Ethan hurt his legs, and some cold metal tools, so it was hard to get comfortable. One of the tools was easily identifiable as a gun. The acrid fragrance was unmistakable. I turned away from it, trying to ignore the sharp smells. I lay in a half crouch, my nails extended in a hopeless attempt to keep from slipping from one side to the other in the narrow trunk as the car bounced and swayed. It was the strangest car ride I'd ever had, and the only one I could remember that wasn't any fun. Still, car rides always resulted in a new place, and new places were always fun to explore. Maybe there would be other dogs, or maybe I was going back to live with Wendy. The cramped, dark space soon became quite warm, and I found myself thinking of the room I'd been placed in with Spike back when my name was Toby, and I was taken from the Signora. I hadn't thought about that scary moment in a long time. So much had happened since then. I was a completely different dog now, a good dog who had saved people. After I spent a long, miserable time in that trunk, the car began to vibrate and ping, and dust rose up in the air, a thick, choking cloud. I sneezed, shaking my head. Then the car braked to a sudden halt, sending me crashing against the inside of the trunk. The motor didn't shut off, though, and we sat for a minute. Oddly, as soon as we stopped, I could sense Victor inside the car on the other side of the trunk, feel his presence. I had the distinct sense that he was trying to make up his mind about something. There was a feeling of indecisiveness. Then he said something sharply, a word that was muffled, and I heard the front door open. Victor's feet crunched on gravel as he came around to where I lay cringing, and I smelled him before the trunk popped open and cool air whooshed in around me. He stared down at me, blinking. I raised my eyes to his, then looked away so he wouldn't think I was challenging him.
"All right."
He reached down and twisted at my collar. I expected him to attach my leash, so I was surprised when the collar itself fell away, leaving behind an odd sensation, as if I were still wearing a collar, only one light as air.
"Get on out of here. Now."
My legs were cramped as I stood up. I recognized his hand gestures and jumped out of the car, landing awkwardly. We were on a dirt road, long green grass waving in the sun from both shoulders. Grit from the road painted the insides of my nose and settled on my tongue. I lifted my leg, looking over at him. "What now?" Victor got back in his car, and the engine made a loud noise. I stared at him in confusion as his tires bit at the road, spitting rocks. He turned the car around, pointing it in the opposite direction. Then he rolled down his window.
"I'm doing you a favor. You're free now. Go catch some rabbits or something."
He grinned at me and took off, the car kicking up a huge cloud of dirt behind it. Baffled, I watched it go. What sort of game was this? Hesitantly, I followed, easily tracking the dust as it drifted through the air. I knew from my many years of find that I was quickly losing the scent. Victor must be driving very fast. I gamely picked up the pace, no longer following the dust cloud, but focusing instead on the signature smells from the back of his car, where I'd just spent so much time. I was able to track him when he turned onto a paved road, but when another turn took me to a highway with cars flashing past at amazing speeds, I knew I'd lost him. So many cars were whizzing by, each one with smells similar to, though not exactly like, Victor's. Picking out the one scent on which I was doing fine was impossible. The highway was intimidating. I turned from it and headed back the direction I'd come. With nothing else to do, I backtracked along the same scent trail, now faint in the late afternoon breezes. When I came to the dirt road, though, I passed it and kept heading aimlessly up the pavement. I remembered when I used the trick my very first mother had taught me and escaped from the kennel when I was a puppy the second time, how it seemed like such an adventure to run out in the open, free, and full of life. Then the man found me and named me Fella, and then Mom came and took me to Ethan. This was nothing like that. I didn't feel free. I didn't feel full of life. I felt guilty and sad. I had no purpose, no direction. I would not be able to make my way home from here. It was like when Colonel turned away from me the day Derek took me to live with Wendy. Though no feelings came from Colonel, it was nonetheless goodbye. Victor had just done the same thing, except he had handed me to nobody. The dust and heat made me pant, my thirst itching at my mouth. When I picked up the faint scent of water, it was the most natural thing in the world to turn in that direction, leaving the road and walking through high grasses that tossed themselves back and forth in the breeze. The smell of water grew stronger, more tantalizing, drawing me through a stand of trees and down a steep bank to a river. I waded into my chest, biting at the water, lapping it up. It felt glorious. With my urgent thirst no longer my only concern, I allowed myself to open my senses to my surroundings. The river filled my nose with its wonderful damp smell, and along with the gurgle of the waters, I could hear very faintly a duck squawking over some imagined outrage. I padded along the bank, my feet sinking into the soft soil. And then it came to me with such a jolt, I lifted my head in surprise, my eyes wide open. I knew where I was.
Chapter 28.
A long, long time ago, I had stood on the banks of this very river, perhaps on this very spot, when Ethan and I had gone for our long walk after Flair, the dumb horse, abandoned us. The scent was unmistakable. Doing fine all those years had taught me how to separate out odors, categorize and store them in memory, so that now I could instantly remember this place. It helped that it was summer, the same time of year, and that I was young and my nose so sharp. I couldn't possibly fathom how Victor might have known this, or what it meant that he had released me so that I would find the place. I had no sense as to what he wanted me to do. Lacking any better idea, I turned downstream and started trotting, retracing the very same steps Ethan and I had taken those many years ago. By the end of the day, I was hungrier than I could remember ever being, so hungry my stomach cramped. Wistfully, I thought of the old woman's pale hand poking through the fence and dropping little pieces of meat for me to snatch out of midair. The memory made me drool. The riverbank was choked with vegetation and made for slow going, and it seemed that the hungrier I became, the less certain I was of my course of action. Was this really what I should do? Follow this stream? Why? I was a dog who had learned to live among and serve humans as my sole purpose in life. Now, cut off from them, I was adrift. I had no purpose, no destiny, no hope. Anyone spotting me slinking along the shores at that moment might mistake me for my timid, furtive first mother. And that's how far back Victor's abandonment had thrown me. A giant tree that had snapped during the winter and fallen by the water formed a natural hollow on the bank, and as the sun faded from the sky, I climbed into this dark place, sore and exhausted, and completely puzzled by the changes in my life. My hunger woke me the next morning, but lifting my nose into the air brought me nothing but the smells of the river and the surrounding forest. I followed the flow of water downstream, because I had nothing better to do, but I was moving more slowly than the day before, hobbled by the empty ache in my belly. I thought of the dead fish that sometimes washed up at the pond. Why had I merely rolled in them? Why hadn't I eaten them when I had the chance? A dead fish now would be heavenly, but the river yielded nothing edible. So miserable was I that when the rough bank gave way to a footpath redolent with the scent of humans, I hardly noticed. I ambled lethargically along, only halting when the path rose steeply and joined a road. The road led to a bridge over the river. I raised my head, the fog lifting from my mind. Sniffing excitedly, I realized I had been here before. Ethan and I had been picked up by a policeman on this very spot and taken for a car ride back to the farm. Many years had obviously passed. Some small trees I remembered marking at one end of the bridge had grown to be towering giants, so I marked them again. And the rotting planks on the bridge had been replaced. But otherwise, the smells were exactly the same as I remembered. An automobile rattled by as I stood on the bridge. It honked at me, and I flinched back from it. After a minute, though, I hesitantly followed it, abandoning the river for the road ahead. I had no idea where to go now, but something told me that if I went in this direction, I would eventually arrive in town. Where there was a town, there were people, and where there were people, there was food. When the road joined another, the same inner sense told me to turn right, and I did so, though I shrank guiltily away when I sensed a car coming, sliding into the high grasses. I felt like a bad dog, and my hunger only enforced this belief. I passed many houses, most of them set far back from the road, and often dogs would bark at me, upset by my trespass. Around nightfall, I was slinking past a place with a dog smell when the side door opened and a man stepped out.
"Dinner, Leo. Want dinner?"
he asked, his voice carrying that deliberate excitement people use when they want to make sure a dog knows something good is happening. A metal bowl was dropped with a loud clang on the top step of a short set of stairs. The word dinner arrested me in my tracks. I stood riveted as a squat dog with enormous jaws and a thick body eased down the steps and did his business a few feet into the yard. The way he moved suggested he was an old dog, and he didn't smell me. He went back and nosed around in his bowl a little, then reached up and scratched the door. After a minute, it opened back up.
"Are you sure, Leo? Are you sure you can't eat anything?" the man asked.
There was a sadness in his voice that reminded me of the way Al cried in the yard that last day I spent with him and Maya. "Okay, then. Come on in, Leo." The dog groaned, but couldn't seem to pull his back legs up the last step. So, with tender gentleness, the man bent and picked the dog up, carrying him inside. I felt myself powerfully drawn to the man and was struck with the sudden thought that this could be a home for me. The man loved his dog, Leo, and would love me. He would feed me, and when I was old and weak, he would carry me back inside his home. Even if I didn't do find or school or any other work at all, if all I did was devote myself to the man in the house, I would have a place to live. This crazy, purposeless life I had led as bear would be over. I approached the house and did the sensible thing. I ate Leo's dinner. After the weeks of tasteless, gritty dog food at Lisa and Victor's home, the succulent, meaty meal in Leo's bowl was the best thing I'd ever tasted. When it was gone, I licked the metal, and the clang of the bowl against the side of the house alerted the dog inside, who woofed warningly. I heard him approach his side of the door, wheezing, a low growl mounting in volume, as Leo became more sure I was there. It didn't sound as if Leo would be very receptive to the idea of me living in his house. I bolted off the steps, so that by the time the light flicked on to illuminate the yard, I was already back in the trees. The message in Leo's hostile growl was clear. I would have to find my own home. And that was okay. With my hunger sated, my longing to live here had gone away. I slept in some tall grasses, tired but much more content, my stomach full. I was hungry again by the time I found town, but I knew it was the right place. The approach fooled me. I passed so many houses, their streets bustling with cars and children, where my memory told me there should have been only fields. But then I came upon the place where Grandpa used to sit with his friends and spit vile juices out of his mouth, and it smelled the same, though there were sheets of old wood over the windows, and the building next to it was gone, replaced by a raw, muddy hole. At the bottom of the hole was a machine that pushed great piles of dirt in front of it as it moved. Humans can do that. Take down old buildings and put up new ones, the way Grandpa built a new barn. They alter their environment to suit themselves, and all dogs can do is accompany them, and if they're lucky, go for car rides. The volume of noise and all the new smells told me that humans here had been very busy changing their town. Several people stared at me as I trotted down the street, and each time I felt like a bad dog. I had no real purpose now that I was here. A bag of trash had fallen out of a big metal bin, and it was with a huge sense of guilt that I tore the bag open and pulled out a piece of meat covered in a sticky, sweet sauce of some kind. Rather than eat the meal right there, I ran behind the metal bin, hiding from people, just as my first mother had taught me. My wanderings eventually brought me to the dog park. I sat at the edge under some trees and watched enviously as people threw soaring discs for their dogs to catch in the air. I felt naked without a collar and realized I should hang back. But the way the dogs were wrestling in the middle of the big yard drew me like a magnet, and before I could stop myself, I was out there with them, rolling and running and forgetting myself in the sheer joy of being a dog at play. Some dogs didn't come out to wrestle. They stayed with their people or sniffed along the perimeter of the park, pretending that they didn't care how much fun we were having. Some dogs were drawn to tossed balls or flying discs, and all of them eventually were called away by their people and given car rides. All except me. But none of the people seemed to notice or care that I didn't have anyone there with me. Toward the end of the day, a woman brought a big female yellow dog to the park and let her off the leash. By this time, I was exhausted from all the play and was just lying in the yard panting, watching two other dogs wrestle. The yellow dog excitedly joined them, interrupting the play for sniffing and tail wagging. I lurched to my feet and went to greet this new arrival and was shocked by what I smelled along her fur. It was Hannah, the girl. The yellow dog grew impatient with my feverish examination of her scent and spun away, eager to play. But I ignored her inviting bow. I excitedly dashed across the park to the dog's owner. The woman on the bench was not Hannah, though she too carried Hannah's smell. "Hello, doggie, how are you?" she greeted me as I approached, my tail wagging. The way she sat reminded me of Maya, shortly before Gabriella the baby arrived. There was a sense of tiredness, excitement, impatience, and discomfort, all mixed together and focused on the belly just below her hands. I thrust my nose at her, drinking in Hannah's scent, separating it from the woman, from the happy yellow dog, from the dozens of odors that clung to a person and were a jumble to a dog not trained in find. This was a woman who had spent time with the girl very recently. I was sure of it. The yellow dog came over, friendly, but a bit jealous, and I finally allowed myself to be drawn into a tussle. That night, I folded my black body into the shadows, watching alertly as the last cars pulled out of the parking lot, leaving the dog park in silence. My stealth came to me so easily, it was as if I'd never been taken from the culvert, as if I were still there with sister and fast and hungry, learning from our first mother. Hunting was easy. Trash cans were brimming with containers full of delicious scraps, and I avoided headlights and pedestrians with equal caution. Hidden, dark, feral once more. But there was a purpose to my life now, a sense of direction even more powerful than the one that had brought me to town in the first place. If, despite all the time and changes, the girl, Hannah, was here, then maybe the boy was here, too. And if Ethan was still here, I would track him. I would find Ethan.
Chapter 29. After more than a week, I was still living in the dog park. Most days the woman with Hannah's scent would bring her happy yellow canine, Carly was the dog's name, to the park. The smell of the girl reassured me somehow, made me feel that Ethan was nearby, though Carly never had the boy's smell on her fur, not once. Seeing the woman and Carly always brought me racing joyously out from the bushes. It was the high point of my day. Otherwise, I was a bad dog. Regulars to the park were starting to act suspicious toward me, staring at me and radiating caution as they pointed at me and spoke to each other. I no longer approached their dogs for play.
"Hey there, fella. Where's your collar? Who are you here with?"
A man asked me, reaching out with gentle hands. I danced back from him, sensing his intention to grab me and not trusting the name, fella. That's when I felt the deep suspicion in him and realized my first mother had been right all along. To remain free, one had to steer clear of people. My thought was to find the farm, the way I'd found the town, but that proved more difficult than I would have supposed. Whenever I'd gone for a car ride to town with Ethan or Grandpa, I'd always used the smell of the goat ranch as my point of reference, a beacon for my nose. But all traces of the goats had mysteriously vanished from the air. Also vanished was the bridge whose rattle signaled the divide between car ride and car ride in town. I couldn't find the place at all, not by smell nor by any other sense. Padding along quiet streets after dark, I'd be confident of my direction, and then a large building would block my path, and my nose, with the smells of hundreds of people and dozens of cars. A fountain of water in front of the place added even more confusion to the air, the mist carrying with it a faint chemical smell, like when Maya washed clothes. I lifted my leg against the thing, but that provided only momentary comfort. At night, my black fur felt like protection from discovery. I melted into shadows, hiding from cars, emerging when there was no one around. Always on find, always concentrating on what I could remember about the farm and its scent when I breathed in the night air. Frustratingly, I couldn't pick up a trace of anything. Meals came from trash cans and the occasional dead animal by the side of the road. Rabbits were best, crows the worst. I had competition, an animal the size of a small dog with a very heavy scent, thick, bushy tail, and dark black eyes prowled the bins, adroitly climbing up their sides. Whenever I encountered one of these things, it snarled at me, and I gave it a wide berth, seeing nothing in those teeth and claws but an invitation to pain. Whatever they were obviously too stupid to realize I was much bigger and that they should be afraid of me. Also stupid were the squirrels in the park, who descended from their trees and bounced around in the grass as if the entire area weren't protected by dogs. I had come very close to catching one, except they always darted up trees and then sat up there complaining. Carly the yellow dog often joined me in the hunt, but even together we were thus far unsuccessful. I knew if we kept trying, one day we'd capture one, though I wasn't sure exactly what we would do then.
"What's the matter, honey? Why are you so skinny? Don't you have a home?"
Carly's owner asked me. I picked up the concern in her voice and wagged my tail, wishing she would just take me for a car ride and drop me off at the farm. When she stood up off the bench, struggling to get to her feet, I sensed a hesitation in her, as if she was going to invite me to walk with them. I knew it would be okay with Carly, who always ran out into the dog park looking specifically for me, but I pulled away from the woman's magnetic concern, acting as if I had someone nearby who loved me and was calling me. I trotted a dozen yards away before I stopped and glanced behind me. She was still watching me, one hand on her hip, the other resting on her stomach. That afternoon, a truck pulled into the parking lot with such a strong dog smell, I instantly picked it up from where I lay in the grass at the edge of the park. A policeman got out and chatted with a few dog owners who pointed at various places in the park. The policeman pulled out a long pole with a noose on the end, and I felt a chill go through me. I knew exactly who that pole was for. The policeman walked around the edges of the park, gingerly peering into